Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
This is Mark Yarm, the author of Everybody Loves Our Town, An Oral History of Grunge, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
I'd like to welcome to the program the editor, producer, and host of the podcast, Input Output. A writer, you have quite a few credits, so I pulled this off your website, so let me know if I missed anything. Your work in the past can be found from anything from The New Yorker, The New York Times, Wired, Wall Street Journal Magazine, and Rolling Stone, and probably most importantly to this show, you are the author of Everybody Loves Our Town, An Oral History of Grunge. Mark Yarm is the person I'm talking about. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Baco. Appreciate you having me on the show.
That's quite a rundown, man. You stay busy, it sounds like.
Yeah. Spread out over a number of years, so it's not like not too crazy.
Cobras and Fire, we follow you on Twitter. And a few hours after you actually agreed to be on the show, you tweeted out simply, "Today sucked." So I just want to apologize.
That was unrelated to the request.
Okay.
I guarantee. I can't remember why, but I think it's just like post-election. I'm happy with the election results overall. Mm-hmm. But just kind of that post-election malaise, and the it's getting dark here in New York, like at 4:30.
Yeah,
it's just and we're entering into a COVID winter. So, and there might have been more specific things going on, but it wasn't related to your request.
Okay, well, that's good to hear.
I'm always happy to get a podcast request.
Right on. Well, why don't we start a little bit with you telling us, the audience, a bit about you, and how did you end up writing the oral history for grunge?
Sure. I used to be a senior editor at Blender Magazine, which was a competitor to Rolling Stone, print magazine, if you recall those.
And I was a subscriber.
Oh, you were? Mm-hmm. Wow. For a long time?
At least 2 or 3 years. From issue one, I don't remember what exactly I dropped out.
Okay. But, wow.
Because wasn't it, it was tied into, not FHM, what was the other one? Maxim?
Yeah, it kind of birthed out of Maxim, but it became its own thing. By the time I was there at the very end of the run, which was, I think it folded in 2009. So I was there, and around toward the end, I did an oral history of Sub Pop Records, which at the time was celebrating its 20th anniversary. Now it's more like 30 years. Mm-hmm. And, I did that oral history, and a book agent contacted me and said, "Would you like to expand this to an oral history of grunge as a whole?" And I foolishly agreed, and I spent the next couple of years working on this book, Everybody Loves Our Town, and ended up interviewing over 250 people from all walks, from sort of the hangers-on up to some of the big stars, up to Courtney Love-style people. And it's been almost, next year will be a decade since it came out. It was time to be released, mostly to Nevermind's anniversary.
Okay.
And which I guess will be 30 years old next year. So it's amazing how the decade has passed. But yeah, I mean, there's not a month or two that goes by where somebody isn't contacting me to talk about grunge, or it's something I guess I'll always be associated with, even though I, obviously, coming, I had a very outsider vantage on the scene. I wasn't involved in it at all, except as a listener. So people think I'm from Seattle. I'm not from Seattle. I'm from the East Coast, born in Connecticut, live in New York, Brooklyn. So totally different vantage point. But I think that that sort of helped in some ways, the outside vantage point.
So you were a fan of the music scene, or
yeah, I was definitely. I mean, I was in college when Nevermind and 10 hit, and big listener of college radio and what was alternative radio at the time. And I mean, I wasn't like a subscriber to the Sub Pop singles or club or anything like that, but I was certainly. Listening to those bands and right. enjoying them and enjoying the, I mean, it was, you know, there was a very soap opera-ish until it turned really dark. Obviously there was a very soap opera-ish tone to a lot of these things with, you know, big characters like Kurt and Courtney and Eddie and Lane and Chris Cornell. And, you know, it was, got dark a little later, obviously.
Right. And maybe we'll get to that.
Sure.
With some of that, the characters and things of that nature, were you anybody that, like, because I know some people were like, I don't know how to, I'm not phrasing this very well, like the Nirvana versus Pearl Jam kind of thing. Were you more all-encompassing and pulling it in, or was it kind of something that you actually had your favorite band and kind of?
Back then, it was a big thing. I don't know if you remember that.
That was
a big divide between. Now it seems it's been over the years. It doesn't seem like such a big deal. The Nirvana verse. I mean, especially since Pearl Jam, obviously, they're still around.
Yeah.
but I mean, that was a huge divide. I was definitely on the Nirvana side of things,
Ooh.
And I probably still am to be honest. Yeah.
Fair enough.
They were the quote unquote more authentic of the bands, you know, even though obviously they were both on major labels and both sort of signed the same deals and went in similar directions. But one band was seen as more authentic than the other, for better or worse.
Yeah, and there's reasons for that. I actually would say, even though I'm probably more of a Pearl Jam guy, I kind of concede the point there. I was a freshman in college when Nirvana broke. And so it was the perfect time and the perfect music for me, you know. And I won't get into this too much because this has come up on the show enough for people to know. But you know, I was a headbanger metalhead during high school, and that stuff related to me then. But as I grew up and my brain kind of, you know, became more mature, somewhat anyway, that music didn't connect with me lyrically, and so Nirvana and like I said, Pearl Jam, the big ones at first, and then other bands after the fact, of course. But it just spoke to me a little more, and it just seemed like a right time for the change. I don't know. Thoughts?
I mean, yeah. I mean, that was the transitional period. The hair metal was. I mean, there is, and I think I get into it in the book a little bit. You know, sort of the idea or the myth that grunge killed hair metal, where you know, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people argue that it didn't in fact kill hair metal, because hair metal was already naturally receding.
I'll pause you for a second there. That's one question I ask everybody that when we're doing an album episode is, like, you know, we do side one and side two, and in between I have like these stock questions I ask everybody. So do you want to just, what I'll ask you, did grunge kill hair metal? You kind of answered it, but
yeah, I mean, I think I answered it there. I don't believe it did. I mean, it might have hastened its demise, but it was already, well, you know, it was already kind of waning by that point.
Yeah.
And you know, as I tried to interview a bunch of hair metal guys
you got Brett Michaels.
I got Brett Michaels, and Brett Michaels was kind of like, you know, the big bands like Poison and Bon Jovi and Def Leppard. And I mean, there's all those bands are still around. So yeah. It obviously didn't kill them off. And they're still here. Nirvana's not here anymore.
Right.
So, you know, I think it was just going, you know, these things wax and wane. And I think at that point, hair metal was definitely on the decline. And you know, I think people were maybe hungering for something that felt more authentic, or, you know, I can't say exactly, but hair metal had seen it. So I don't think it killed it, but it might have helped. It might have helped, but I think hair metal would have.
Yeah.
I mean, every musical movement sort of waxes and wanes on its own. Yeah, but so that would be my answer to the question.
Well, let's talk about the book a little bit. I'm a big fan of the oral history. There's one on the Replacements that I loved. And, it, you know, it's just kind of that same kind of vibe. It almost seems almost like it's more challenging to do it that way because there's a lot of organization involved in this. Would you find it easier or harder, do you think, now that you've done one?
They are very difficult to do or very difficult to do well. Because you're so reliant on, you know, I mean, that was the biggest pain in the ass was getting people to talk to me or hunting people down or finding people or getting through to them. And, I mean, it's a pretty common format at this point, but to do it well, a lot of people don't really do it well. I mean, you have to have, I would hope that people reading mine would see that there's a flow to it, I mean, I didn't use a lot of oral histories do stuff like they'll have interstitial descriptions, and mine just is like I do an intro, and then from then on, it's just all the voices of the people I interviewed. So, and sometimes that takes a lot of work going back to people, getting the fill in blanks, etc. So
that's one thing I wondered. Was there a lot of times where you get to a certain point of the book and you go, fuck, I got to talk to such and such again?
Yeah, definitely had to follow up with a lot of people when you hear a story from them and you have to check it out with them. And, you know, so that could lead to multiple. I mean, I say I interviewed 250 people, but a lot of them I interviewed multiple times. So right. That's a lot of interviews.
Any of them done in person?
Yeah, a number of them. I went out to Seattle like three or four times and did a bunch there. Did some in New York. A lot of them were on the phone. So a mixture of phone and in person.
Okay. Well, when you're doing these, right, a lot of these stories, especially in this one, there are so many intermixing characters, if I'm saying that right. You know, in one person's story, you might have people who are in several different stories. From an organizational standpoint, that seems like a nightmare. It's like, you know, because you are keeping it in order kind of. There is a certain, like I said, it goes in chronologically, but also kind of starts and stops per band a little bit, especially at the beginning. How do you, because you're talking to one person who gives you, like, something for four different segments, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I had these index cards where I kind of mapped it all out. And, I mean, basically, I started with the six bands who were in the Deep Six compilation. Mm-hmm. Came out on CZ Records in the mid-80s, and it was a few bands you recognize, maybe a few bands you don't. I mean, the most famous being Soundgarden. Melvins were on there, Green River, Malfunction, U-Men, and Skin Yard. So I interviewed, you know, people from all six of those bands, and that was kind of my year zero, sort of.
Yeah, okay.
Starting there. I started with the U-Men, who has, I recount in the book, did this great prank at the Seattle Mural Amphitheater where they lit the moat on fire, which was, you know, I kind of wanted to have a big boom of a start. So I started the book there. You can see pictures of it in the book itself. And and from there, show how all those bands, I mean, you look at a band like Green River, they, you know, they basically led to Mudhoney, Pearl Jam, Mother Love Bone as well. So. Yeah. So, I mean, it was super incestuous scene, which is also very helpful in making a book like this because it was so, everything was so interwoven.
Right.
You know, all these people knew each other. It's like, there aren't really, I mean, people ask me all the time, could there ever be a scene like Seattle? I mean, the answer is maybe, but probably not because, I mean, I don't know, it's just because there was, this was obviously pre-internet. And people were just stuck in this place that was not the cosmopolitan place it is now. And they had nothing to do except hang out with each other, make music. Obviously, the rain is always cited as a factor, you know, keeping you indoors and honing your craft. And they all, before they became famous, sort of cross-pollinated with each other. So
that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, so there was a lot. So, yeah, I don't, you know, people ask me all the time if Seattle, like, scene could happen again, and it doesn't seem very likely. I mean, it could, but doubtful.
Yeah, I mean, there really hasn't been a scene since of any kind, you know what I mean? Not even something on a smaller degree. This was probably the last legitimate kind of scene, I think.
There have been movements more than scenes, I guess. Yeah. I mean, there have been, you know, like electronic music, obviously, followed that. And you know, there's all sorts
Justin Bieber,
but he's, I think he defies categorization or being part of it. He's definitely not part of a scene unless you count him as...
Well, the internet, you know, he was discovered on YouTube.
Yeah, people who emerge from YouTube would be a scene, I guess. But those people aren't, like, going to the same clubs night after night, getting drunk together.
Right, no.
You know, it's a whole different thing. I mean, TikTok stars are... Well, I guess
there
TikTok
you go.
Stars now, they all live in the same house, but... a lot of them live in, you know, they have those houses, but I don't know. It doesn't seem likely that regional scenes like that will really be a thing of the future. But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, well, I actually hope so, but I'm not optimistic any more than you are. But I tried to come up with a clever way to phrase this question. Did Mark Arm think you were messing with him when you introduced yourself?
A little bit. I'd spoken to Mark for the initial Sub Pop oral history, because, as you know, he was on Mudhoney, and he was working at Sub Pop and still works in the mail room.
Right.
I mean, he's like sending out packages. You know, he's the manager of that, I guess. And so, yeah, it was a little weird. It was more weird with people. I'd contact them, and I mean, it was a good icebreaker,
right?
Because you're like, oh, Mark Arm, that's funny, haha. It was a good icebreaker, and I do have a picture with I met Mark Arm. I mean, I've met him on a couple of occasions, but at the Sub Pop 20th anniversary, I have a picture. I call it Mark Yarm and Mark Arm, arm in arm. Because we're like have our arms around each other, so it's So we it's a little weird. It's a little confusing, but I mean, for a while, I had on all my accounts like this is not Mark Yarm. You know, people confuse us. It is a little confusing, but Mark Yarm is my real name. It is not Mark Arm's real name. So, I think I have more of a stake.
Oh, nice. Yeah. What is the genealogy of Yarm? It's not a name I'm familiar with.
It was shortened. My family came from Eastern Europe. It used to be Yarmovsky, so okay. No, it's just Yarm. There aren't that many Yarms out there.
Well, you actually touched on something that's coming up here, that lighting the moat on fire story. Mm-hmm. That was the human, right?
Correct.
Okay, but that's one of the examples of like where different people remember very specific things in totally different ways that I really enjoy for some reason. Like, I think they all had a different song that they were playing when it happened. And it's just funny reading it, because you go from one to one to one, and it's like, yeah, and it's not written like, no, he's wrong, it's this. They're just retelling the exact same thing. It just, I don't know. I think that actually adds to the enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain Rashomon-like quality to the remembrance of these things. I mean, sometimes it's more of a conversation between people about, no, I didn't do this. So and so did this, or, you know, I mean.
Yeah, some are more important than what song you're playing, too. You know,
Yeah. But doing a project like this, you realize how malleable memory is and how fallible and malleable. I mean, people will twist it to, I mean. I don't have the best memory of myself, so it's amazing what people can remember. Although, it's amazing what people can remember from 20, 30 years ago, but this was also, for many people, like, I mean, it's their early 20s and kind of the peak. I mean, what could be more exciting than being in a band in your early 20s?
Right.
So they tend to remember, and I'm sure these are well-worn road stories, a lot of them. So,
right.
Yeah. It's, it's definitely interesting to see how different people remember things differently and what, who becomes the villain and who becomes the hero in these stories. So
it gets kind of debated a little bit, like who was actually should be called the first grunge band. Do you have your own take on that?
Do I have my own take? I mean,
who would you consider the first one?
You know, there are people that saying, you know, that grunge definitely, I don't know. You know, there's definitely a lot of debate about the etymology of the word grunge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a fun part, too. Steve Turner of Mudhoney says that, like, you know, he first saw the name in a record from the 50s or something, grungy guitars. So, and, you know, there's a whole chapter in the book dedicated to, like, this idea of when grunge came out. I mean, Sub Pop, the label, was sort of popularized the word by using it in their marketing materials, and that became a marketing term, and then it became what we know today as, you know, grunge. Sort of an amorphous thing, but you kind of know it when you hear it. So I don't know. I mean, you could say Black Sabbath was a grunge band. I mean, you know, you could. I mean, obviously, they had a huge influence on grunge band. I mean, I wouldn't consider them one, but they were definitely an influence. But you know, I think those first, you know, the bands on the Deep Six is kind of where I started grunge. So like in 85, 86 or so. So
when did you first hear Deep Six or hear about it, that compilation?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. I think people would argue. I mean, all the people who had songs on there, I don't think they would think that was their best work by any means.
Yeah.
So, I don't know when I heard about Deep Six. It must have been like, I mean, I'm sure I read about it well before I did the book, and I can't recall. But it wasn't. It's not like an album that lots of people have, it's definitely a landmark album in its own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say it's like an album I listen to very often, but
I ask because I heard by going through this list, that was my first exposure to it. And then even just tracking down the audio of it was a little bit of a challenge.
Is it on the list?
It is. It's like number 23. So,
so we
went through that record. It was, it was fun, you know, as a fan of the bands, kind of hearing like the early almost, I don't know, versions of these guys, like before they kind of were able to morph into the level that they got to. So as a listener, I enjoyed that with the Melvins and Soundgarden, especially two of the bands I like down there. But yeah, I mean, it is what it is. You know what I mean? It's a local band, you know, kind of deal. So, but I had never heard about it back in the day.
And what album are you up to in the current podcast?
We just posted last week Stone Temple Pilot Core, and the next one coming up that we recorded just this weekend is going to be Pearl Jam Versus.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was considering doing for the book. Originally, it was like a little bit more expansive. Like I reached out to like Stone Temple Pilots and Bush and Silverchair, but for the most part, none of them wanted to do it.
Yeah, really.
I didn't think they liked the grunge association. So I did, as you've probably read the chapters on Candlebox, and they were kind of the punching bag for most of these guys. Like, the people hate Candlebox, but they were actually from almost entirely from Seattle. But there was always this rumor that they were from L.A. and that they had, you know, just come in the gold rush that came after Nirvana and Pearl Jam. But so there was. I mean, it was enough as is, but it became a lot more Seattle-centric. I didn't cover, like, I mean, obviously Bush are from the UK and Silverchair is from Australia and Stone Temple Pilots from San Diego. So it became a little bit more focus on Seattle.
Yeah, and well, I mean, fair to say that is where everything kind of grew from. So anybody that kind of came in after, it's, I don't know. I thought it was a good way to focus on it. I mean, and plus, the book's long enough as it is. I mean, it's like 560 pages.
True, true. I don't think they would have published much longer than that. So, yeah. but, yeah, it definitely helped me focus. You know, sometimes who would talk to you would help you focus down. But, I mean, I think Candlebox was a good representation of the sort of vitriol that, I mean,
yeah,
over time, Stone Temple Pilots have become a lot more respected. I don't know if you remember how they were kind of maligned back in the day.
We got into that by this guy.
By you. Yeah,
I took me a while to get over that little bit of bias because it did seem like they were opportunist at the time.
Yes, and I mean, if you listen to the first album, they definitely were. So in my humble opinion, but
yeah, I still stick with that. It's still good music, but yeah, I don't know. I just
And then you did Versus, which was a huge album. That was huge. If you remember, I guess Versus and In Utero came out. They were in competition. They came out around the same time. I think
In Versus Utero was coming up yet.
Yeah. And what's the number one on the Rolling Stone list?
It's Nevermind.
Ah, bold.
Not a big shock, huh?
Yeah.
The Andrew Wood stuff. Now, have you seen the documentary on him that's on YouTube?
I have.
I think
the malfunction documentary.
There we go. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just was blanking me.
No, it's okay. It's really good. I like that a lot. I thought that was. I watched that. Actually, somebody sent me a copy of it before it came out, so I kind of got a sneak preview of that when it was still doing the festival circuit, and I quite like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. For as low budget as it is, it's actually pretty well done.
Yeah. There are a couple, I mean, I didn't like some of the interstitial effects and stuff, but I thought content wise, it was really good. There are a bunch of grunge documentaries. I like the Tad one a lot.
I would check that one out.
Yeah. You should check that one out. Tad had, you know, a very tumultuous career. And the same people did a Mudhoney doc, which was good, but I think suffered from, I guess Mudhoney didn't have as, you know, didn't have as much hardship and controversy, and there wasn't a much dramatic arc as there was to the Tad documentary, which I thought was really good.
Mudhoney is largely the same four guys, right? Is it all four, or is it just three of the four?
Three of the four, okay. Yeah. So Matt Lucan left, and then bassist. But yeah, I mean, you know, they're all nice guys. I mean, they had obviously there's some dramatic tension there, but it wasn't like Tad where they got like, you know, their record pulled. And they had controversy with a supposed you know, they got dropped from multiple labels, and they had this big brash frontman. It's just like a totally different story. So, but I would recommend that Todd. I think it's called Ringing Ears and Busted Circuits, I'm not mistaken. That's a good documentary. I mean, obviously Hype.
Yeah.
Is the standard bearer. I talked to the director, Doug Prey, who was quite kind and quite a good guy. And, you know, kind of, he came in like very late and like, I think grunge had kind of peaked or was peaking when he came in, you know? So people are like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? But he would not be talked out of it. So that's a really good documentary. So I would check that one out too. If you're,
I have seen that one.
Yeah. That's a good overview for the listener out there. If you want to get a good grunge overview, I'd say Hype, start with that first.
But back to the Andrew Wood stuff. I got kind of a slightly more, I don't know, depressing version of Andrew's home life from your book than I did from that documentary, probably largely because your book wasn't put together to be a celebration necessarily of any one thing, you know what I mean? So maybe, and it was just through some of the, I can't remember who was talking about it, but he talked about how they moved a lot. And there was constant fighting where that stuff is talked about in the documentary. So in fairness, I'm not trying to say they glossed over it, but they definitely, they made it seem like, well, things, sure, once in a while things got rough, but, but I don't know. It seemed like there was a little more honesty, especially with the breakup of Malfunction. Or not, yeah, right, Malfunction was the band with his brother?
Correct.
Yeah, Kevin. And where they never really got to deal with that, you know, the fact that he kind of bailed on them to do Mother Love Bone and didn't really have a conversation with his brother about that. So that detail, kind of sucks, but it's more painted in your book a little cleaner than that documentary does.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the advantages of the written word over a documentary. I mean, obviously, you can go into a lot more granular detail. And that's a notable thing of the lack of communication. I'm just going to quit the band, but not tell anybody. Or, something like that. Like, or we're going to replace you with a new drummer, but you're only going to find out when you walk in on practice. But you think about it, these were 18-year-old non-communicative dudes. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like they were hashing. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of hashing things out, but there was also a lot of passive aggressive behavior. And it was just you got to keep in mind that these are teenagers, basically, mm-hmm. late teenagers. So
had you heard of Mother Love Bone before he died? I had not. I'm putting myself
before he died. That's a good question. So he died in, I'm going to say, 91. I don't have it right in front of me.
Yeah, I think that's right, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, the dates always become a little blurry. Yeah. But had I? That's a good question. I mean, I don't like that name for a band. I think it's a terrible name.
Yeah, I do too.
But, had I heard of them? I don't recall.
Pearl Jam had definitely broke before I ever heard any story about him at all or all that stuff. So,
right.
And then,
by all accounts, they were poised. Andrew Wood was you can see it in that film that you talked about, super charismatic and just a wonderful performer. So, he probably could have broken through. And, he was certainly seemed destined to get there.
He seemed like he wanted to leave the band, though, and be a solo artist. And at least that's the impression I got watching that documentary. He was, kind of frustrated with the band dynamics and how things have to be somewhat political at times.
Well, I'm sure he could have done his own solo stuff and had foot in both those worlds. But I guess we'll obviously never find out. But it was certainly, by all accounts, he was going to be a star. He always acted like a star.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about how he would say hello, Seattle, when he was in some divey little club and playing to the imaginary rafters. There was no upper balcony, but he
you see footage of that in the movie where he does something like that. It's pretty hilarious, actually, because...
It was, by all accounts, a super hilarious guy, so... I think and they kind of had a little bit of a, they had one foot in grunge. They had kind of look at them. They look a little Guns N' Roses-y. Mm-hmm. I could see them fitting into that milieu a little bit. So, it's quite possible they could have done well,
sure.
You know.
Well, musically it was right on path with Pearl Jam, obviously. So.
Yeah.
I did like the story of him meeting David Lee Roth when he was younger.
Oh yeah.
And he's like, I'm on a schedule, son. I thought that was just I could just see, from what I understand about Andrew Wood, that would be a big moment for him. But
I could see that. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to meet David Lee Roth.
Yeah, me too.
maybe put out in the universe and he'll come on your podcast.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, it's one step at a time, man.
from Mark Yarm to David Lee Roth.
Right on. Yeah, 6 degrees of separation.
Steps.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know him. Sorry. But
well, maybe someday you will know him. Anyway, Kim Thayil, obviously you talked to him. And by the way, I've always wondered how his name is pronounced. Is that right? Do you know Thayil?
I mean, I've kind of fudged it a little bit. It's Thayil, Thayil.
Okay.
Thayil.
All right.
I probably pronounce it both ways. But yeah, he's a great guy, though.
Okay, that's my question. Like, I think he kind of comes off just
Is he a great guy?
No, he comes off a tad prickly in interviews sometimes. I just was curious what... I actually just wanted to know what your experience was like with him, you know.
I'm actually, of all the people, I still keep in touch with him, you know. Mostly, you know, text him every once in a while or whatnot. But he's a super good guy, super funny, super smart. I mean, he can be a little prickly, I guess, when you ask a dumb question or something. Not that I ask a dumb question, but...
That's my job.
He's very protective of his privacy. And, I mean, I can only imagine, you know, since Chris Cornell has died, how that has kind of affected him. And, yeah. You know, obviously people want to know the details of that. And I'm sure he doesn't want to share too much, but, yeah, he's a great guy though.
Was there anybody that you wanted to talk to that didn't want to be involved that was actually part of the scene? I know you mentioned some of the, like the, Bush and those kind of guys, but, what about,
I mean, I ended up using some sort of, some archival stuff for some of the members of Pearl Jam who I couldn't talk to, because Pearl Jam, if you might recall, were doing their 20th anniversary. It was the Cameron Crowe documentary and their own book. So, I mean, I talked to all the Pearl Jam drummers. So there were 5 Pearl Jam drummers. I talked to all of them, which I thought was a good feat. I pulled that off. And which, as you might notice, have you seen the Cameron Crowe documentary?
The 20?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have.
It's kind of mediocre, I think.
Really?
It's
celebratory, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would have been much better documentary had they gotten the voices of, like, the drummers in there. If you notice, they're not in there except for Matt Cameron, I believe. And it's very, like, felt a little Wikipedia to me, like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, but...
As a fan, I enjoyed it, but I think I don't disagree with a single point you're making. You know what I mean?
Didn't love it. I thought it was kind of like too light a touch and just a little bit of a hagiography. I don't know. It just didn't really appeal to me. When I saw it, I was like unimpressed.
I've been listening to Kiss since I was 7, though, so my standards are really low.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Well. Oh, we should read this new book at David Broad, who's a friend of mine, wrote. It's coming out soon. I think next month, December. Did I call him David Broad?
Yeah.
Or did I call him
Doug I think Broad? It's David Broad, but I...
It's not right.
You guys sound close.
Doug Broad. I'm sorry. I said the wrong name. Terrible me. Anyway, it's a good book. I blurbed it. It's called... They Just Seem a Little Weird. It's about Kiss, Cheap Trick, Aerosmith, and Stars, which was kind of a band I had never heard of. And all these bands in the late 70s and how they redefined rock and roll. And they have very, like, interesting... It's not oral history. It's a, you know, just a...
Okay.
Regular history and how all these bands intertwined.
Well, if Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley weren't involved at all, it might be pretty good. But
I think he interviews Paul Stanley in the book. So
okay,
and
well,
maybe some other. You should check it out.
I'll definitely check it out. But I would venture to guess or hypothesize that Paul Stanley won't say a single thing I haven't already heard him say a few times. Although, you know, Paul's book is a fascinating book. I mean, it's very chippy. a lot of cheap shots, but, you know, I mean, it's just, as far as entertainment, I don't really know if I could, you know, gloss a lot of reality out of it, but I don't know.
Right.
A little bit on Pearl Jam, because, and I won't say it for the recording. If you care to, I'll tell you when we're all done here. But there was one person I interviewed who, during the course of the interview, had a bunch of very nice things to say about him. About them as a band, and afterwards...
About Pearl Jam.
Yeah, afterwards he asked me to not include that, if I could take that out, and I thought that was odd. I've never had anybody ask me to take out a compliment they had for somebody, you know what I mean? Typically it's like, maybe I shouldn't have gone there, do you mind taking that out, that kind of thing. There is... I'm learning through reading your book more than I think I understood when that was time. I'm guessing that's because there's a lot of people who look at them... Like, they basically kind of turned their back on everything from Andrew Wood to the Seattle scene and that kind of beef we talked about early on between them and Nirvana. Did you encounter much of that? in your research that like there are kind of some negative feelings towards those guys from that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely were, but
I guess because they weren't the only successful band, but they seemed to take a heap load of that more than say Soundgarden or Nirvana.
Right. It's odd that people would be. I mean, people were very complimentary of Pearl Jam because they, whether you like their music or not, they conduct business in a way that, you know, they're all for the good socially. You know, they took on Ticketmaster. Failed, but you know they still tried. You know they support all the correct left wing causes that you would want them to support. They supposedly treat their crew and staff and everything very well. It's kind of a family situation. So I'm surprised that somebody would. I mean, I would think people not wanting to have a crossword about them getting out because, you know, they're still big business mm-hmm. and they still, you know, they're still touring with, you know, and you don't want to, you know, some people I spoke to who were still employed by them many, many years later in whatever capacity, you know, whether as a stagehand or a roadie or whatnot. So, it's unusual that somebody would say don't. Maybe they didn't want to seem too ass-kissy.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh, it's almost like there's like some street cred he's worried about losing or something. Oh, you know what I mean?
You don't want to praise the... I mean, I don't know. At this point in 2020, I don't know. It doesn't seem like...
I wouldn't think so, but I found it surprising, but some of it was validated reading your book. But anyway, other things I found surprising. Kurt Cobain actually had designs on being a massive rock star. That kind of goes against his narrative. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think anyone who's read, I mean, there's a bunch of Nirvana biographies, and I think anyone who's read them knows that he had very conflicting feelings about fame. On one hand, he really desired it. I mean, he wrote about it in his journals and, you know, and talk about it with other people, Courtney Love, for instance. But then on the other hand, I mean, he came from this underground punk rock scene where that was sort of reviled. So he was very conflicted about it, super conflicted. But he wanted it and he didn't want it. I think he wanted it, but in a way that wouldn't make him on MTV every minute. Although apparently, you know, I talked to Danny Goldberg, his manager, Nirvana's manager, and, you know, he said that Kurt would used to count how many times Nirvana's video played versus how many times Pearl Jam's video played. So, and then, you know, basically be noting that. And so it's a pretty well-known push and pull between wanting to be famous and not wanting to be famous. I mean, I think that I don't want to be armchair psychiatrist, but I think it fed into...
Yarm chair.
Never. That's a good one. I think it led to, you know, a lot of his. I mean, he had heaps of other problems, but that was definite.
Well, speaking of heaps of problems, how many times did you talk to Courtney Love?
I think I spoke to her like four or five times.
Any crazy nuts stories with her?
I mean, you see some of it in the book. At one point, I mean. She kind of breaks the fourth wall a little bit. She's like, I'm going to hang up on you if you ask that question. You know, like she kind of raised her voice to me a few times, but like to what Courtney must be like, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was probably like a 2.
Okay.
But to me, it felt like, oh my God, this lady's yelling at me. But, she was very giving of her time, which I am thankful for. And originally she said she wasn't going to talk about Kurt, but then of course she started talking about Kurt.
Yeah.
Right away. So, there was a lot. I mean, I don't follow her on Twitter anymore, so I'm not sure where she's at right now. Do you know?
I don't know. I've never really been a fan. I think she's interesting as a character, but I mean,
she's interesting as a character, but I love her music too. I mean, I love the first three whole albums.
I'm pretty sure.
Are any of those on the list?
Yep, it's coming up.
Live Through This must be, right?
Yep, Live Through This is like 5, I think. And I'm pretty sure my research for that is going to make me or expand my knowledge of Hole and Courtney.
That is an incredible album.
Really?
I will go to the mat for that one. And I think it's super sexist. I mean, Courtney Love deserves a lot of the criticism that's lobbed against her because she could, in many cases, be an awful person. But, you know, the whole idea that Kurt Cobain wrote the album or was, like, really instrumental in writing it, you know, I think it's just sexist stuff and erasure of her and, of, you know, like Eric Erlandson, who is the guitarist in Hole, who obviously wrote a bunch of that. I mean, I think the next album, obviously, Celebrity Skin, you know, Billy Corgan was heavily involved in. I think, that, you know, it's pretty credited, but...
I thought that was largely music, though. I've always thought that she was, I guess, again, I'm not an expert.
Oh, lyrically. Yeah,
I thought her contribution was largely lyrics and melody. Yeah. And you know, it's not an uncommon trait in songwriting to have somebody who writes music with you, and then you kind of do that, you know, so.
Yeah, but I think she was super maligned in artistically. I mean, she did some awful things to some people and was obviously erratic and could be quite cruel to people. So, I mean, I can see how she could, like, just, like, be like happy-go-lucky and then turn on a dime, like, when you're talking to her. So, yeah, but I was grateful for her to... give the time for sure.
Yeah, she. I saw Hole at a like a radio station festival in '98, and she had a great meltdown on stage that was one of the highlights of the day. I can't remember what she said anymore, but for life of me, but she went off, man.
I can't remember. It was '98 by the time she had like the new band with the dudes behind her.
Oh man, yeah, I think
all the years blurred together, but that was a pretty.
I think so, because the Samantha Maloney was in Motley Crue by that point, I believe.
But it was the all guys.
Yeah, I honestly don't recall. It seems like the timeline's right, because that happened where that was after Celebrity Skin, I think.
Yeah.
I'm guessing by the way you're talking about Courtney that you're convinced that she did not have Kurt Cobain murdered.
Right. I mean, I think that's. I mean, I address that in the book a little bit because I didn't want to give too much credence to conspiracy theories. I think that's. I mean, I've said it before. I'll say it again. She most definitely did not, assuredly did not have anything. I mean, did not have him murdered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether the relationship, obviously the relationship fed into his mental state at the time, but I believe 100% he killed himself. Of his own volition. And I mean, she wasn't even in town at the time. I mean, I think that there's a documentary, is it called Doused in Bleach? I think, which I saw, and which is, you know, just.
Is that the one where
old...
they reenact the private investigator?
Yeah.
Okay, I watched it too.
Tom Grant, who's made basically a career for the past. However many years it's been, 25 years or so of investigating this case. Again, I've kind of tapered off on how much I pay attention to that. But I mean, it's sort of almost like a little bit embarrassing that he's still harping on that so many years later, like just some local private investigator. I mean, people get really into the case and it's really sad because then like a new generation of kids who didn't know, weren't there, didn't know about it, sort of see something like that documentary and then become, you know, convinced that it's true. I mean, all the signs point to it not being true. And I mean, the guy was a prodigious heroin user and depressed. I mean, people say, well, he had a daughter. But I think a lot of people, it's also... I mean, I suffer from depression, so it's somebody who doesn't understand. I mean, not like Kurt Cobain, mind you. It's not that sort of level of depression, thankfully. But, you know, they don't understand, like, what the mindset of a depressed person is, especially one with stomach problems and a heroin addiction and this fame that is, you know, probably more ruinous than good at that point. You know, there were rumors that he was, you know, on the verge of divorcing Courtney at that point. Whether that's true or not, who knows? But you know, he was, his life was not in a good place, despite the fame and the fortune and having a newborn daughter. So people don't understand that. And it's unfortunate. And the whole conspiracy stuff is kind of sickening. And I mean, Courtney did a lot of things wrong, but she did not. She did not have her husband killed. I mean, there's also that Kurt and Courtney documentary, which I guess is. I mean, it's. Have you seen that one?
I haven't watched that one, but
okay, that one also explores the conspiracy theories there. So,
do they leave it more open than the one? Because that one basically says this is what happened, people.
Yeah. It's a little more open ended, but they have like. El Duce of the Mentors.
I did see that one. Oh, you okay, did see that. I'm sorry. Yeah, that one.
Which was obviously, he was like, I haven't seen it in a while, but he appeared to be under the influence of something when he was talking. I mean, it was obviously bullshit.
Right.
But, I mean, those films do a great disservice to, I mean, I understand why conspiracy theories exist, but it's just unfortunate. And it's unfortunate that for all her many faults, that Courtney has been tarred with that.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a very sympathetic character, and that kind of works against her, you know. So, you know, maybe when she does something right, you know, it's just not going to get the attention that it might deserve. So, I mean,
but it is, now that you bring it up, it is amazing how benign those conspiracy. I mean, even though they're malicious, they're sort of benign compared to like the QAnon and conspiracy theories that are going on now about cobbles of like Hollywood sex perverts draining the life essence of kids and stuff. I mean, that makes the Kurt and Courtney stuff seem pretty quaint.
Yeah, really. So let's get back to that level of no. I'm saying I'm with you. I'm like, I want Kurt and Courtney kind of conspiracies, not the shit we're dealing with now, Pizzagate and all that garbage. And
I want conspiracies like Stevie Wonder isn't blind or something. Something like harmless.
Yeah.
You know, it's like fun and harmless.
How does that even become a thing? Who decides one day, is Stevie Wonder really blind, or has he been faking it for 40 years, or...
And apparently there's some video that shows that he's, you know, reacting, like
catches
like
a ball.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, but I don't believe that one either. I don't believe pretty much any conspiracy theories. So.
Yeah. For the most part, I don't either. They exist without evidence, despite evidence. But
yeah,
as much as it's fun, because these are bands and albums, especially now we're getting into the sweet spot on the list for the big hitters. You know what I mean? Music takes you back, you know what I mean? It kind of puts you in that same sense of mind you were at the time. And it's been fun for me to kind of go back and remember that part of my life. But one thing that is like a dark cloud over all this, too, is just all the people that aren't here with us anymore, because there was a lifestyle that these guys were living that took so many of these people from us, you know what I mean? You know, we've talked about Andrew Wood, but, you know, Chris Cornell is gone recently, you know, Lane, of course, and you know, the one that we were just talking about, Kurt Cobain. Was there any part, like, while compiling this together, where things got to almost depressing for yourself to kind of realize, you know, what was going on here? And, you know, just the tone of the darkness where it almost had an effect on you, if that makes any sense.
There was a lot of stuff. I mean, I remember a few late night conversations with people talking about their heroin use. It got really dark, and it was like, it was hard to go to sleep after that. And I spoke to Mike Starr, who was, you know, the bassist in Alice in Chains. I spoke to him the day he died or the day before he died. I was on the phone with him briefly. And he was like at the doctor's office or something. And then like the next day I found out he died. It was super dark. I mean, he was in trouble. I mean, I don't know if you recall, he was like on Dr. Drew's show and he was in rehab or out of rehab. And, he was definitely, using at that point. So, it was not pretty. So, I mean, I got to talk to him like, somewhat, but it was shocking to have somebody like die the next day or 2 days later, you know.
That is really heavy. Did you find him believable? He seems to have a reputation for not being the most reliable.
Yeah, I don't think he was the most reliable person. I mean, I think he was a little bit of a fabulist, and I'm not sure what to believe of what he said. And, okay. You know, I don't know what was said under the influence or, you know.
Yeah.
So,
I'm not trying to throw dirt on the guy. I'm just really, asking.
Right.
Well, how about on a more positive note, what are some of your favorite stories from the book?
That's a good question. I mean, I like the story about, you know, there isn't that much new Nirvana stuff. So I like the story that Bruce Pavitt of Sub Pop told about talking to Kurt Cobain backstage at SNL when they were on the first time. And Kurt Cobain, like, this was the weekend that they unseated Michael Jackson for the top of the charts with Nevermind. And Kurt Cobain was like in a good mood and musing about, you know, how he could open a petting zoo or something, which Bruce Pavitt pointed out was very much like a Michael Jackson sort of thing, you know, yeah. Like Neverland Ranch sort of thing. And then of course he pointed out that Kurt Cobain famously overdosed that night. So, you know, it kind of pointed out the happy-go-lucky side of Kurt Cobain, and obviously the very dark side. So, I don't know. There's so many stories, you know, like the Melvins encounter with Shirley Temple Black.
Mm, that was good.
Who's the mom of their bassist at the time?
I swear you covered in the book, but Buzz was dating her, right?
Yeah, Buzz was dating Lori Black, who was
Lorax.
Lorax, and they got to meet her. So yeah, I talked to Lorax quite a bit on the phone, but she never wanted to go on the record, unfortunately. So
wow,
yeah.
Was there some salacious stuff there? Or
yeah, you might say so. Okay. But I mean, I think also because of I think her mom was definitely still alive at that point. I don't think she wanted to embarrass the family any further.
All right. Know. Well, fair enough. That's kind of surprising. I didn't think she would have anything that out there. But what about Mark Lonegan? He graciously passed to be a part of this project,
right.
Even though he's got a new album to promote and a book that recently came out. Now, his book, apparently, I haven't had a chance to read it, but it is apparently one of the most brutally honest retelling of a drug addict. He's in your book. I mean, you must have.
Well, I didn't talk to him. I used
okay,
some so archival stuff. Yeah, he did not want to participate. He does not particularly like the book, so
nice.
In some ways it might have encouraged him to write his own book. So
really, you think that's the catalyst, huh?
Well, I read an interview with him where he mentioned that. So, but the rest of the Smashing Pumpkins, the rest of the Screaming Trees spoke to me. So that was cool. They're, you know, like the Connor brothers and the drummers. And
I enjoyed talking with Gary.
Oh yeah, you talked to Gary. That's cool because he's like kind of shy and doesn't really talk as much as like Van. So that's a good get.
Yeah, no, I read it. Well, thank you. I tried to get in Van too, but I never heard back. Gary seemed to intimate that Van might be drinking a little too much right now. But
it's quite possible.
Yeah,
it's a lot of drinking in this scene. I mean, that's the thing. Also, like you think you say, like grunge was so related to, you know, is so intertwined with heroin use. In the public's mind, but I mean, a lot of these people were just straight up alcoholics, there were a lot of heroin addicts, but there were a lot of alcoholics as well. I mean, I guess they're two sides, but and a lot of times they didn't really mix. You know, heroin's a very like backroom, seedy sort of thing, and
sure. And
alcohol is obviously a little bit more front and center. So, but that's definitely a possibility.
You know, and Chris Cornell, it came up in that documentary on Andrew Wood, but it's touched on in your book that he was actually sober for a pretty good chunk of time.
Yeah.
And if I understand right towards the end here, the drugs he was dealing with were more like antidepressives, kind of maybe overprescribed kind of things. So
sounded like that, yeah.
Do you know anything about like any substance abuse issues that he might have had? I don't know, during like the heyday of Soundgarden.
No, I mean, from what I gather from, I mean, he used drugs early on, and then he quit, and then he was like, I don't think he took up the drinking and drugging until much later, until his 40s or so. So, I mean, I know he was, you know, I mean, he spoke quite openly about that.
Well, let me ask you this. Up to this point, the one band that I feel I missed out on at the time was Screaming Trees. When we did that record, Sweet Oblivion, I was like, this was right in my zone, especially for that time. I mean, it's a masterful record. Is there a band from that scene that you think probably deserved a little bigger of a shot than maybe they got? Maybe they're a lot like the Screaming Trees, where they kept kind of shooting themselves in the foot a little bit.
I mean, I think Mudhoney, I mean, they're rightfully recognized as kind of the godfathers of grunge, or whatever, however you want to describe them. But I mean, I think that, I mean, originally Sub Pop thought that Mudhoney, not Nirvana, were going to be their big breakout band,
right?
You know, the band that road to fame and fortune, but they weren't. They were kind of I think Mark Arm or Steve Turner has described them as a footnote or something in grunge history, but I mean, they're just Super Fuzz Big Muff must be on that Rolling Stone list.
Yeah,
right?
That's coming up. Yeah,
that's my favorite grunge album, I would say. So I think that's it kind of epitomizes grunge, and all the songs are great, and it's just Touch Me, I'm Sick is as great an anthem for grunge as you can get, I think. So yeah, there are a lot of bands. I mean, Tad, as you'll see in that documentary if you watch it, is were kind of poised for bigger things but kept shooting themselves in the foot. And, you know, a lot of bands, and one of the things I tried to do in the book was try to be, and I think what some of the people who spoke to me appreciated was, it wasn't just about the big four bands, it was about the Tads and the Money Honeys and 7 Year Bitch and L7 and Malfunction and the U-Men, and just maybe names that people aren't familiar with but were integral to the scene.
Well, the book's named after a Mudhoney lyric, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And would Mudhoney be your favorite band from that scene?
Definitely one of them. I mean, certainly Nirvana guy, Mudhoney. I mean, I like Bleach would probably be my second favorite grunge album, I would say. So, but yeah.
All right. Well, what about favorite album? Do you have a favorite album from that time?
Well, I would say it would be Super Fuzz Big Muff, and singles would be my favorite. And Bleach would be probably second favorite. So, well within the Sub Pop family for sure.
Did you like the singles soundtrack? Do you think that was a decent representation?
I do like the singles soundtrack. Singles, the movie, I have a love-hate relationship with. I think the movie itself is not great, but I love the parts with the bands, and it's just such a great time capsule of the Seattle scene. And you know, the part where Tad picks up the phone, and the guys in Pearl Jam being stoned watching the Nature document. I don't know. I just love those parts. But as a romantic comedy, not so great. But as a sort of time capsule of Seattle in that era, definitely great.
Well, do you still listen to anything? Like, how frequently do you dig back to those albums?
They come up. I have them in rotation in my Spotify, or, you know, random, they come up. Obviously, sometimes it feels like a little bit, like, really, because I wrote about it, it feels like work.
Yeah.
I still listen to them quite often, I'd say.
Are you going to do another music biography kind of book or anything like that?
Probably not. Yeah, I mean, if I did another book, which I have no plans to do, it would probably be something totally different. But music is a young man's game. But, maybe not. Writing about music can be a young person's game for sure.
Hey, how long did it take you to finish the book, like, from when you started?
It took, like, 2.5 years,
okay.
I'd say, give or take, you know, from the time I did the oral history until I handed in, you know, until it came out. So it was time consuming and very, you know, overtook my psyche. I guess it was like my one thing that I was focused on. So it was it's a lot of work. I mean, anyone who's written a book of any sort can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, it is a fascinating book. Mark, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I hope I was a gracious host.
You were very gracious.
Your book, you said, Everybody Loves Our Town, is available pretty much anywhere you can get books. I mean, people go to Amazon for the most part. That's where I got mine. But, you know, there are still some Barnes & Nobles around that maybe have it on the shelf.
Yeah, or go for an independent bookseller.
Yeah, even better. Yeah. See, I got to keep with that grunge cred, right?
IndieBound or Bookshop or one of those places. And if anyone wants to look me up, I'm on Twitter. I'm always on Twitter. It's at Mark Yarm.
And some days he has days that just suck, by the way.
Yeah, I do have days that suck. But like all of us. But today is a good day. It ended well with this conversation about grunge. Baka, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate your time so much. We got so much material here. So this is awesome. So, well, say hello to your wife, Bonnie. Did I get that right?
Oh, you did. Oh my God, you're a stalker.
I'm doing well, either that or just we call it research on this side of the camera.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. I will give her your regards.
Yeah.
And thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a good night, Mark.
All right. Take care.
Vikings, they're playing tonight.
Go sports.
You sound like my wife. Awesome. Have a good night, man.
Bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.